This is Game Retro, a show about what video games mean to and say about people. On this episode, we talk about education, programming, and punks. I'm Zoe Landon, and I'll be joined by the founder of Zachtronics, Zach Barth, to talk about Space Chem. In Seattle, Washington, there's this park. Just off of Lake Union, pretty much smack dab in the middle of the city, geographically, at least. And it's a fairly ordinary park, in a lot of ways. You got your rolling hills, your paths, your occasional trees. Actually, a very nice view of downtown, in my opinion. And there's this area with a chain link fence. Now, usually when there's a fenced off area in a park, it's probably a dog off-leash area or, you know, tennis court, something along those lines. But here behind the fence is a bunch of rusted tanks. Lots of dirty pipes, overgrown foliage. The fence says no trespassing. And there are a couple more tanks throughout the park. You can walk right up to some of them. I wouldn't blame anyone for looking at this and calling this an eyesore. But they're here. They're part of the park. And more than that, they're part of our story. This is Gas Works Park, and it was here that Zach Barth, founder of Zachtronics, started to put together the idea for Space Chem. Space Chem is very difficult. Very, very difficult. Since its release on Steam in March 2011, only 4% of players have ever finished the game. And I'm not one of them, personally. The rumor is, Zach Barth isn't even one of them. It's that hard. Space Chem is a puzzle game, first and foremost. The player has to take inputs of various chemical elements, a bit of carbon, a bit of hydrogen, and attach them to make some kind of compound. And that means building tracks for those elements to move along and adding commands to tell them what to do. All of this in a relatively small working grid. Not tiny, but small enough to be frustrating from time to time. And these puzzles are all tied together with this story of space exploration. It's called Space Chem, so no big surprise. And the tone is slightly dark, not necessarily dystopian, but it's very aware of how dangerous something like deep space exploration could theoretically be. A couple characters even die, which is not exactly a puzzle game thing. But even then, the game went over really well. Since its March 2011 release on Steam, the game has sold over 500,000 copies. And that's according to the tracking site Steam Spy. And that doesn't include copies sold on Zachtronics' own website or on other platforms. For a puzzle game, and an indie puzzle game at that, the number is pretty good. Zach, for one, has called it a success. So was Space Chem a success as an educational game? Well, that wasn't the point, at least not initially. To hear Zach Barth tell it, the whole idea came a bit later.
Space Chem was when I thought, man, I really want to make some educational games. I think that this thing that we're able to do, these kinds of games that we're able to make, are, like, they don't fit into curriculum perfectly, but, like, they're actually, like, educational in that they teach people or encourage or require creative thinking and problem-solving skills.
Sure, Space Chem is maybe a weird option, but it's an option. So Zach and his team went for it.
We wrote up a document when Space Chem came out, which is, like, the Space Chem Guide for Educators, which you can actually still find on our website, I think. And it's, like, it's just us attempting to, like, connect it into, like, oh, this is how you could use this in, like, a programming curriculum.
And that guide is still there. But nobody uses it. Because for all its chemistry context and programmatic problem solving, nobody, as far as Zach knows, sees Space Chem as an educational game. Now, if we're going to talk about why something does or doesn't work as an educational game, it helps to look back at where the whole idea of educational games comes from. And really, we need to go back even before video games. We can go back over 1,000 years, in fact, back to chess and its use as a way of learning war strategies. Problem there is that the history of chess is a bit convoluted and murky, so we can't absolutely say the game was created in order to teach, especially with how it's evolved over the centuries, changing the rules around to make the game more fun, more game-like. But we can certainly look at the 19th century pedagogue Friedrich Froebel. He developed a number of theories that helped to define modern education. He even developed kindergarten. And part of that original idea of kindergarten was this set of Froebel gifts. They were early educational toys, sets of crafted items meant to better engage children and keep them active. They're still used by some schools even today. But then we get to the educational video games, and there are a lot of them. Millennials like me might remember playing Oregon Trail or Reader Rabbit on school computers if we were lucky enough to have them. A lot of them work the same way. You take some academic domain, math, literature, whatever, and wrap a game around it. And that's still the model today, more or less, and it fuels a segment of the video game industry worth over $2 billion. Zachtronics got a slice of that market when they signed a deal with the education company Amplify. Now, Amplify creates core and supplemental curricula, and they incorporate tablets and mobile devices in their toolkit. And so when Amplify was getting started, they wanted to include a couple of games. Not really as part of the curriculum, just something for the kids to find.
And so the guy in charge of the games program reached out to me and a bunch of other indie developers, and we made these, like, I don't want to say fabulous, because I think all educational games are, like, super dodgy, but we made these, like, very original educational games. Like, none of us were education people. Like, but we're making these, like, educational games, and, like, we made some really wild stuff.
That project was the first time Zachtronics made explicitly educational games. Now, there were three in total. Metabolism was all about starch metabolism. Habitactics, a match three game exploring the carbon cycle, and had a blunt tutorial mentioning how eventually everything dies. And there was Factor, a more action-y game centered around prime factorization. But Amplify was new, and the games were a little bit buried.
We signed up for a three-game contract. By the time we were working on the third game, it became really clear to me that no one was learning anything from our games, and that it was like we were making these games that we sold to this company that was having a really hard time getting them out in front of any children. So nobody played them for years, and when they did play them, they were really confused about what they were supposed to be learning from it, and they didn't learn anything.
Those three games are the only explicitly educational games Zachtronics ever made.
Everybody, and welcome to Let's Look at Opus Magnum. The first thing you need to know about this game is that it is a Zachtronics game.
When the first thing game reviewers do is point to your company's name, you probably have a bit of a reputation. And that reputation started with Space Kim. Zachtronics has become a kind of shorthand among indie game fans, particularly among puzzle game fans. It means heavy logic challenges. It means solutions that are as much programming as they are play. It means histograms and other tools to encourage players to really fine-tune their solutions and hone in on maximum efficiency. Basically, it means Zachtronics games are nerdy as all hell. And that's a feature, at least as far as their fans are concerned. They talk about playing Zachtronics games and hitting a seemingly insurmountable problem, banging their head against what some have called, and I quote, a brick wall of stupid. Now, the announcement of Zach's latest game, Exapunks, has, of course, brought a fresh wave of those flustered sentiments to Reddit.
Looks like another game that I'd like to buy, but I'm too damn stupid to play. I feel Opus Magnum was the only title I was smart enough to play right.
Their games have zero appeal to me, but I'm glad they're making them. Every genre needs good representation. Maybe one day I'll grow an extra brain and tackle these.
But that's today. When Space Chem was released, Zach was just some guy who made some games. He had a bit of audience to push him along.
Was it for people? It was so. It was for those people who had been playing my previous games, is who Space Chem was for.
But he was no Phil Fish. And if you don't know who Phil Fish is, well, Zach was even less well known. So if Zach wanted Space Chem to make any dive into the educational world, he was going to have to reach out to teachers on his own. he was going to have to find a way in. SpaceCam wasn't designed to appeal to the educational market. Remember, that whole idea came later, after the game was designed and released. So it didn't exactly scream educational, and it wasn't going to. Zack would have to do something to make SpaceCam more appealing to teachers than whatever it was competing against. So Zack made the classic capitalist decision, offer it up for cheap. A $10 game is a hard sell, but $5 would be easier. Or $5 could still be too much. And that was the issue Zachtronics ran against. They just couldn't sell the game to teachers. It was too strange. So they just gave it away.
And that was, without realizing it, the smartest move I've ever made, because they're not going to buy it. But what they do is that saying that it's free means that, like, people who are just looking to write an article that's about, like, things for teachers, they're just like, oh, look, SpaceCam. SpaceCam's free, so you should try it, like, without even trying it themselves.
After all, understanding educational games is a difficult ask. And with school funding constantly slashed, there's a market out there for telling teachers about anything that's free and vaguely educational. That educational connection can be tenuous, at best. Or it can exist and just be applied improperly.
Like, they're just like, I read in a guide somewhere that SpaceCam is good for programming. I want to put this in front of my students for Day of Code. Like, and SpaceCam's certainly not going to give anybody the right impression. Like, I just imagine, like, a bunch of poor, like, sixth graders, like, shoved in front of SpaceCam because their teacher, like, should have downloaded, like, Spark or something that they actually could do. And, oh, yeah.
Yeah. SpaceCam is programmatic, but it's not programming. It evokes chemistry, but it's not chemistry. But a game doesn't have to exactly mirror reality to be used in an educational context. One of the biggest games in education, in fact, offers up alchemy and dragons. It's 2009. Zack Barth is making various little games, experimenting with ideas, and generally messing about. He starts working with a friend on this competitive mining game. Each team hunts down randomly placed materials and brings them back to their base for points. They called it Infiniminer. The game got a bit of attention on message boards, but as Zack and his partner worked on it, they found that people were more interested in the emerging gameplay that Infiniminer offered. Because, sure, people could dig, but they could also build. And it turns out when you give people a three-dimensional block-based world, they like to build things in it. Pretty soon, the Infiniminer source code leaked. People started exploiting the game and making their own tweaked versions. So Zack stopped working on it. And a Swedish developer, Marcus Persson, saw Infiniminer. He decided he wanted to make the game himself. So he did. And he kept adding to it, and eventually, you get Minecraft. Fast forward to 2013. Minecraft has millions of players. Teachers know that kids are playing this game. A lot of kids. And they're starting to see that maybe Minecraft can be used in educational settings. Teacher Gaming, known at the time as Minecraft EDU, had been promoting that idea for a little while. So educators who had a bit more freedom and leeway started to put together lessons within Minecraft. Lindsay Moulds was the director at ID Tech at the University of Houston back in 2013. ID Tech put together a bunch of programs for students of different ages, and some of them involved Minecraft. It was, after all, an easy starting point.
So Minecraft at the time was really, really, really huge. I guess I think of it as sort of being a precursor to Fortnite in that it was what you could almost guarantee that any student within a certain age group would have played it.
Like most educational programs, ID Tech separated their lesson plans by age. There was a track for the younger students and one for the older ones. And each of them incorporated Minecraft in different ways.
The one that was for younger students was mostly based on sort of in-game logic and sort of using Minecraft as a modding tool with the tools that Minecraft gives you, if that makes sense, which I think of as like valid modding. So they would do things like build, you know, really elaborate levels and sort of use like redstone as sort of a method of teaching programming and teaching logic with music blocks and that kind of thing.
Redstone, by the way, is a material within Minecraft, sort of like electrical wires. You can use it to build simple logical components, an AND gate, an OR gate. Or if you're Seth Bling, the notable YouTuber, you can build an entire computer. So how are people actually using Minecraft in education? Well, the Minecraft Educational Edition website has a whole bunch of lesson plans. And yes, there is a special version of the game specifically for education. Now, some of these are submitted by teachers, some of them are actually maintained by the people who maintain the Educational Edition. And one of these feature lesson plans is called Humans and Elephants. It's actually designed to fit HSLS27 of the Next Generation Science Standards, which is the one that focuses on ecosystem interactions. So it's kind of legit, or at least really trying to be. And this one almost makes sense with Minecraft. For one, Minecraft has a bunch of wild animals, even in the normal game, so that's not new. And the lesson plan focuses on the concept of subsistence farming, using as context the Okavango Delta in northern Botswana. Farming and eating food are both Minecraft mechanics, so okay. That lesson plan takes mechanics in Minecraft and reframes them so they can teach a topic in the standards, fine. But there are lesson plans that deal with literature, and they're a little... Well, consider one that themes around the Fantastic Mr. Fox to cover Common Core standards for K-5 reading and writing. If you look at the lesson plan, there's a lot going on that doesn't really connect to Minecraft. The game just kind of supports the actual lesson. It's a much clearer case of teachers using a game that students are already familiar and comfortable with as a way of getting them to pay attention to the lesson they want to teach. But in a funny way, that's not really surprising, that there are lesson plans that only kind of connect to Minecraft. The game is a sandbox game. It's got mechanics and a loosely defined storyline, but it's flexible. So even if the game wasn't meant to be educational initially, there's room to work. It can still find its way into schools. And Minecraft isn't even the first game to appear in schools, more or less by accident. Consider the curious case of Carmen Sandiego.
Somewhere in the world is
Carmen Sandiego.
The franchise originated in 1985. It was originally marketed as a mystery exploration game, not really intended for schools or children. But a large part of the game, mechanically, involves going from location to location. And in the original, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, those locations were all real places. It also came with a world almanac. Some teachers saw all this as a way to teach their students geography, give them a game that forces them to know more about the real world if they want to win. Brodabund, the game's developer, quickly leaned into the game's educational use. Throughout the 90s, they helped schools put together Carmen Sandiego Days. There was even a Carmen Sandiego trivia show, one that I was unusually fond of. Carmen Sandiego became a household name, even getting a nod from President Bill Clinton. So teachers loved it. Students loved it. Brodabund certainly loved the success. And a 1994 study by J.H. Weib and N.J. Martin found that the game even worked as an educational tool. Though it was no better at it than a generic geography-based board game. Oh, maybe more fun. And yet, the franchise largely petered out by the year 2000, and even up-to-date Carmen Sandiego games are rarely used in schools. So was it a cultural shift, or did the edutainment market collapse? Or did Western educational theory just leave her behind? We'll look at all that after this quick break. Now, since this is a pilot episode, we don't really have sponsors, but I still wanted to take the time and do a couple of shoutouts. And there's this great series of books called Boss Fight Books. They're all fairly short, and each one looks at a specific video game. It does a really deep dive into how it came about, the people behind it, what it means to the author, all that stuff. And they range from the personal, like the really funny breakdown of Metal Gear Solid, done by the Birch siblings, to the technical, like when Derek Yu went deep into the weeds on creating his game, Spelunky. And it's a huge inspiration for this podcast. You can find more info and a link to buy the books on our website, www.gameretro.net/bossfight. And this whole show was put together using Cast, which is not just a hosting platform, it's also got an editor and a recording studio built in. So both of the interviews that I did for this show, we just sat down, used the Cast studio, and that was it. I didn't have to mess with local recording, didn't have to even meet in person. Everything was on the cloud, online, available to edit, download, no problem. Now, if you want to check it out for yourself, maybe you want to do your own podcast, there is a 14-day free trial. You can find more about that on our website, www.gameretro.net/trycast. There is an elephant in the room here. If you're going to make a game about chemistry, you need to know a thing or two about chemistry. A game about military tactics, same thing. Whatever your game is about, you need to understand it. So if you're going to make an educational game, you have to decide, what even is education? And that might seem like an odd question. When we talk about education, we're generally talking about schools, colleges, maybe on-the-job training. Anything that's transferring knowledge. It's that process of sharing information. Whether that's what something is, or how to do something, or why something works the way it does. And this whole question feeds into the idea of pedagogy, but it is a complicated area. Anytime you're trying to figure out what the brain does, you're going to get a lot of question marks and a lot of conflicting ideas. And those ideas are frequently changing. It used to be that we thought about people learning through instinct and response, that Pavlovian bell-ringing behaviorism. But by the 60s, we have things like cognitivism, which treats the brain almost like a computer, along with humanism, which sees learning as more about fulfilling your own potential. And all these ideas came with different approaches to the classroom, different levels of support, and it's worth saying, different levels of credibility. But when you make any game, you design in a certain view of the world. It's inevitable. And when someone makes an educational game, their idea of how people learn gets woven into it. If that idea doesn't fit popular pedagogy, or isn't compatible with what larger interests are pushing, it's more likely to get ignored. And with these theories and interests regularly shifting around, it was inevitable that the Carmen Sandiego approach would fade away in favor of the Minecraft approach. Now, most of these theories don't say much about whether or not using games in education is a good idea, and recent studies are fairly inconclusive. A large-scale 2014 study by Anton Petrov leaned positive, and he does use video games as a teacher today. But on the empirical neuroscience side, we don't really know. But we don't know a lot about the brain. So there's plenty of room for skepticism, even with the Wyben-Martin study and the Petrov study. So maybe it's good that Space Game isn't used in education, because maybe using any games in education is a bad idea. But that would go against what most teachers who have been surveyed have said, what they've observed. So perhaps the next big shift in pedagogy has more virtual blocks than Froebel's physical blocks. There is, by the way, a parallel field of theory around how adults learn things. It's called andragogy. It's generally held as more self-directed than most pedagogical theories. It kind of assumes that adults know how to teach themselves, in a way. And Zach does have to teach himself. He had to study up on chemistry for Space Chem, on circuitry design for Shenzhen IO. For Xbox, he had to dive into 90s hackerzine culture. He now has this big stack of Wired magazines from the 90s. When we talked, he started gushing about their style guide from the time, which actually sounded cool in an extremely nerdy way. But in that whole research process, Zach stumbled upon this idea, edupunk.
It's like some little movement, like there's a Wikipedia page like that's very short about it, and it's not like a real thing, and everybody I told about this didn't really seem to give a shit. I thought it was the coolest thing ever. It's like an educational movement, like some teacher started it, that's trying to like bring like the punk ethos like into education.
Now, Zach's not kidding about the Wikipedia page being short. Edupunk is not exactly a major pedagogical theory. And it'd probably stop being punk if it were. But it resonated with Zach, this somewhat humanist idea of do-it-yourself education. And once you look at it from that perspective, it's no surprise Space Camp didn't go over as an educational game. Because Zach made it, not the students.
More than like anything about like, oh, what kind of games should we be making for like, you know, like teaching stuff? It's like, no, like students should be making games, like not us.
And yes, student-centered learning is a big push in pedagogy. It's about balancing the outside demands for some clear results with a process that helps students learn what they care about. To Lindsay Moulds, it's about respect.
We waste a lot of kids' time. We do. We waste so much of their time. And I think that a thoughtful education would be somewhere between the two, such that we do put emphasis on process, we do put emphasis on learning how to learn, but also you are giving students something foundational that they can work with.
Zach is a little more direct in how he looks at things. He knows what it means to make a Zachtronics game, and by all accounts, he's happy with that. He also doesn't consider his way of making games the way students should be using video games to learn. For that matter, he's not entirely fond of anyone's way.
Right? My games are all about systems. I love systems. I love the idea of trying to build a system that models something in real life, but it's like a simple, like a simplified, like cute version. And I think that like, oh, that's like, that sounds so cool. Like as like a thing for middle schoolers. And like, that's super punk too, right? Like they're not just buying games and letting kids play these games that were made by some game developer. It's like, fuck game developers. Like every kid is a game developer. Let them teach them how to make games and then let them make games about stuff and like, let them, you know, like, take control.
It's probably no surprise at this point that Zach has no plans to ever make an educational game again. But perhaps there's somewhere else in Seattle. Some interesting oddity like Gasworks Park. Maybe it'll inspire Zach's next game after Exapunks. Or maybe it'll inspire some kid to make some game. Maybe they'll make the next Space Camp. And hopefully, in the process, they just might learn something. You can find more information about SpaceChem on our website. It's www.gameretro.net/SpaceChem. You'll also find links to purchase the game on Steam, GOG, or the Android version. Game Retro is hosted and produced by me, Zoe Landon. A huge thanks to Zach Barth for appearing in this episode, as well as Lindsay Moulds. Editorial assistance came from Widower Phaedra Boychuk, Lauren Buss, and Janani Srinivasan. Our theme was produced and performed by Big Giant Circles, with incidental music from the Space Camp soundtrack by Evan Lee Nye. You can find us online at www.gameretro.net. We're at Game Retro Show on Twitter and Facebook. That's all for now. Thanks for listening.